Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Democracy is often loud, messy, and argumentative. After all, it's a system designed to support the right to differing values and political ideas. A healthy democracy allows for dissent and disagreement, peaceful protests, marches, and campaigns that work to persuade voters to support or reject certain ideas. But currently in America, dissent too often turns to violence, where people threaten harm rather than simply debating viewpoints. Why has it become dangerous to express free speech, and how can we get back to more civil discourse in our nation? Two elected officials with opposing political views have found ways to work together, and they'll share what they've learned today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello from Alaska Public Media. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Before we start today's discussion, I wanted to note that our thoughts are with the people of the Yukon-Kuskokwim region, and especially in the communities of Quigilangok and Kipnuk. One death has been confirmed, and many homes were washed away or heavily damaged. As recovery work gets underway, we'll bring updates and reporting on Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. We'll devote next week's Talk of Alaska to learning more about the ongoing recovery and how Alaskans can help. For today, we're discussing how to disagree more agreeably. Public dissent and mass communication today is much different from the era of limited outreach when someone had to stand on the street corner holding a sign to get attention. Now, in addition to street corner protests or supporters, there is the digital street corner, the online world that gives everyone quick access to thousands, potentially millions, of readers and viewers. But unlike newspapers or licensed news broadcasters that must adhere to certain standards of truth or risk legal liability, online platforms are unencumbered by mandates for ethical standards. Lies online don't carry the same legal risk that news organizations have. That means people on Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and others are free to present fabricated content that fits their narrative with no legal jeopardy to the platform that offers it to millions and makes money from it. Is that a big part of why we are so fractured today as a country? Our guests today are both elected officials on the Anchorage Assembly, and although Assembly members don't run as Democrats or Republicans, partisan leanings are often apparent, and today we have one self-described right-leaning member, Jared Gerker, who represents District 2, Chugiak Eagle River area, and one left-leaning member and chair of the Anchorage Assembly, Christopher Constant. Welcome, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Thanks so much. I'm so glad you're both in the studio with me. You can also join us. Have you found ways to discuss political or social issues with family, friends, and coworkers that allow for dissent without anger or a fistfight? What do you think is needed to bring us to a more united Alaska and country? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So the idea for this discussion, you reached out to us. Your outreach stemmed from the online tensions after the killing of conservative Charlie Kirk. There has been no lack of flame throwing on both the right and left and right. Before Charlie Kirk was murdered, a lawmaker in Minnesota and her husband were murdered in the doorway of their home. A man pleaded guilty this month to arson in a fire set at the home of Pennsylvania's governor. And there were two attempts on Donald Trump's life. So what changed for you both that prompted outreach now? What about the Kirk killing prompted this?
Yeah, so I'll take first.
All right, Jared, thank you.
I'll take the first brush at this, and then Chris can come in and clean it up. So obviously, you know, after Charlie Kirk was assassinated, it was a shocking time. I think for a lot of people, because you saw a young father, a husband, just brutally murdered in front of his family and in front of, you know, in front of the nation. And it was shocking to the conscience. And to a lot of people, you know, especially on the conservative side, he was a relatively mainstream, you know, thinker. The views and the perspectives that he had were not, you know, were not something that was really that crazy. And yet he was demonized as being a threat to democracy, a fascist, a Nazi, a trans, all the different, you know, the buzzwords. And following his death, there was a hurtful amount of people online and, you know, on the airways and everything celebrating his death, saying, well, look, this is, you know, so sorry he died, but he really wasn't a good person, right? That was kind of the arguments that we're seeing. And this specific conversation was born out of actually a Facebook post. Somebody, a relatively well-known liberal commentator here in the state, posted something, and I'm paraphrasing here, but basically said, if you're going to celebrate, celebrate privately, right? And Chris had liked it. Chris had liked the post, and a lot of people took that to mean, well, wait a second, is Chris saying we should be celebrating? And so it got sent to me by a lot of different people, and you know, I looked at it and I thought about it quite, you know, at a significant length of time. I sat there. I did not jump on it right away because I wanted to make sure that I'm reading this correctly too. And
that in itself is an important point, that you took time to really think about what you were seeing and reading.
Yeah, and it's important. You know, your first reaction is often the wrong reaction, and so I wanted to make sure that I took some time to really think about it. And you know, the more I thought about it, I was like, you know, this bugs me, and this bugs me because we're seeing people celebrating his death, and even if you're celebrating it privately, you shouldn't be celebrating it at all. Was kind of my perspective. So I reached out to Chris and I said, hey, this bugs me, and this really upset me, and I'd like you to explain, you know, kind of how you interpret this post. What is your meaning here? And we had a very candid, I think, passionate discussion. And born out of that conversation was, we need to be able to sit down and model a conversation like the conversation that Chris and I had, and we need to be able to have this. More people need to be able to have this type of a conversation, and so that's kind of the genesis of it. And I'll let Chris.
Sure.
Yeah. Please.
So the post was made by Libby Bacalar, and essentially what she had said was, if you're going to dance in your head, do it in the privacy of your own home instead of chasing clout, and which I fully agree. And there was a very well-known conservative communicator who singled all of that out and said, Chris Constant is dancing in his head, right? Just completely smearing what my intention was and making it appear that I was in fact celebrating, which I was admonishing people who I am seeing celebrating on the left from, hey, keep it to yourself. You know, people need time to process and grieve. And, but nuance isn't made for the propaganda systems that exist out there. And they just going to put out a message and people are going to believe what they feel is right. It doesn't matter what the words actually said. And so, you know, just to the kind of underlying principle, I fully agree that people should be very careful on how they celebrate the passing of somebody. And I do not celebrate that kind of thing. And I did see people celebrating it. But one thing you learn in this business is you can't control what other people do or how they feel or react. And for me, the message was, do it in the privacy of whatever space. But you out here trotting this around, it's just bad and inflammatory, and the timing could be better. In a sense, not about the celebrating of death, but if you're going to look at his record and say, I think that some of these things are terrible that he said are not mainstream, like if you dig down into it, there are some things that Charlie Kirk had said that were pretty shocking to those of us who are on the other side of the line or in the center. And but the point of today is not to get into the big national questions, but really to talk about how we, who are serving locally in a body that is at the center of this mixture of different opinions in Anchorage, and who has, unlike the state legislature or the Congress, the duty to sit and face the public every single time we meet. We don't, like in Juneau, the public is looking to the backs of the legislature, and in Congress, you're in these tiny little halls, you know, secured by security, and they're way down there, far, far away. So we are the place where people come to tell their government how they feel. And so in that space, we deal with difference as a daily process. Like, that's the whole process of government. It's sorting through differences and coming to an agreement by majority. And it can be tricky, but we can model for the public that we can disagree. We can disagree passionately about things, and we can still meet up and get the work done.
So when you made that outreach, Jared, did you feel like you were sort of taking a risk, or did you feel like you knew Chris well enough that you could make that outreach and kind of take that risk of engaging over something that was clearly very sensitive?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't sure how he was going to respond. We've known of each other for, you know, a number of years through, you know, my work in the mayor's office in the previous administration. And then obviously been on the assembly for the last 6 months together. And look, I found Chris to be, you know, be very reasonable to me and honestly be very kind to me and help me learn the ropes behind the scenes. And so I wasn't sure exactly how it was going to go. In fact, you know, I was talking to a, you know, friend and confidant leading up to it, and they're like, I don't know, actually, you might be making a mistake here. You might just let this one go. But it was important enough to me that I have this conversation with a colleague about something that was, you know, I perceived to be hurtful. So I wasn't quite sure how I was going to go. And honestly, I was pleasantly surprised with how it went. And then obviously, of course, you know, we're sitting here. So like it's went well. Like, we obviously we're able to have a passionate, conversation where I don't think we agree necessarily still, but we're able to at least talk about it. And that's important.
And respect each other as co-workers so that you can get things done for the city.
Well, in that space, like, there was a debate we had, I think it was last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, where we were jousting with ideas on the dais, and it was very satisfying to go back and forth and it not become personal and not become aggressive about you are bad or you are this or you are that, because that's not what, in the ideal sense of platonic debate, you do. You debate the idea, you debate the merits, you debate the resources, you debate how we respond, and not, you know, you're a bad person because you don't agree with what I believe in. I'm a child of the Big Blue Marble. You know, PBS's like campaign of we are all different, and how boring of a world if we all thought the same. And so that's a kind of the product of the world that I come from. I want to know. And I believe in the majority's ability to make the right decision, even when I'm not in the majority.
That's an important aspect of how to disagree agreeably as well. And we'll drill down on that a bit. But I wanted to remind folks that this is Talk of Alaska. If you're just joining us, we're talking about how to have respectful dissent. And in the studio with me is Christopher Constant, the Anchorage Assembly Chair, and Jared Gerker, who is the Chugiak Eagle River District 2 Assembly Representative. You can join our conversation if you have questions or comments or thoughts of your own about how to lower the temperature in dissent in our state and our country and come together more as united citizens. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Chris, you said the coward's path is to just post and join the outrage. The brave path is to reach out and ask to have a discussion about the disagreement, which is exactly what happened between the two of you. Why do you think that's become the exception rather than the norm?
I think that people have a form of dissonance where they disconnect their posting into the world of the social media spheres as quiet and anonymous, or just part of the a broad communication, and they don't really feel like it's them saying this to people, right? They miss the reality that they are in fact communicating something. And so it's much more difficult to have such outraged expressions in the real world, because you're people and you're standing there with your friends or family and they're looking at you, and maybe they want to grind at you, but they would choose better because it's real. But to them, that social media space is probably not real.
Well, continue on that for a moment. You said you don't care so much about online trolls raging at you, but you do care about the feelings of the people you work with.
Absolutely.
Talk about that distinction.
And so just so folks know what she's referring to, we did a little pre-meeting with
Madeline
and kind of talked through some of these things. So Lori's referencing elements that aren't part of this record, but are part of our conversation. And so could you ask the question again?
Yes. You said in an earlier interview that you don't care so much about online trolls raging at you, but you do care about the feelings of people that you work with. And
right.
Talk about that distinction. And
you know, I served when I started on the assembly, it was 2017. Everything was super glossy and we had lots of potential and things were looking good. And then 2019 hit with a major budget recession part that the governor cut funding for homelessness. And then all of a sudden we had waves of people coming in, very angry people from all sides of the equation. And then the pandemic, which just blew up civility. And I have come to compartmentalize away that nastiness because it's just out there and nothing you can do to control it. And if you touch it, it expands. And I mostly don't engage. I have narrowed my presence and I don't do muni business on the web. But the angry people, what are you going to do? But somebody you connect with, somebody you see, again, it's the same in the grocery store, at the rock gym, you're going to be more open to the conversation as long as they're decent in their approach to you, right? You're probably going to be matched if you come out as pretty aggressive. I'm probably not going to get much of a response, but if you come out, I have a thought for you. I don't like what you're doing, but be decent about it. I'm here for that. I love to hear that. These are the conversations that really make good policy. I joke with my peers that, I hear from people of different political persuasions that, hey, I don't always agree with what you say and do, but I really, as a whole, appreciate your work. I hear that a lot from people on the other side of the aisle. And my standard response that has evolved over 9 years almost is that, yeah, you know what? I also don't agree with myself after a good debate all of the time. And that's the entire purpose of our process, is to have a meaningful debate on ideas, on things we're divided on, so that we can come up with the best decision. And so I too am persuadable from somebody who provides a reasoned argument that makes sense and is more reasonable than what I thought.
And so much of it's just basic, starting from a place of sort of mutual respect for your humanity. I know when people call, I get all kinds of calls, and sometimes people are really angry when they call. And you can be angry, but if you start yelling at me, okay, please stop. I'd be glad to have a debate with you, a conversation with you, but please don't yell at me because I don't want to be yelled at. I'm not going to yell at you. I don't want to be yelled at. That's not part of my job to have to listen to you yell at me. So let's have a discussion. Jared, you talked some about the post and how you approached Chris about talking about it, but you said it wasn't heated, but it was passionate, it was intense. Describe how you were able to approach that, and did you kind of have some ideas in your mind about, well, if it gets to this point, then maybe I'll say, look, we better stop and we'll pick it up at another time? Or were there kind of some mental guideposts that you had about how to engage?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I had a, if this button's flashing, like abort, abort. I want to say I had that. That's not really my personality. Mine's like, okay, well, I've picked a fight now, so now I'm going to have the fight. And I don't think that's what it was. It wasn't a fight.
No.
But I think that because we were able to both recognize, hey, this is becoming a heated conversation, and we lose the ability to actually communicate and hear each other when we're listening to respond instead of listening to understand. And so that was my mindset going into it. I want to understand where he's coming from on this, because I don't want to believe that a colleague would be celebrating the murder of somebody, right? Like that's something I want to believe. And reasonable people can disagree on the intent and everything. And I would still quibble with the fact that we shouldn't be celebrating, even privately, even in the contented quietness of your own home, you shouldn't be celebrating somebody's death.
I agree with that.
And I appreciate that. But all of that gets lost in the online world, where it's all about rage. It's all about keeping your base riled up. And look, this is a problem that is getting worse, I think, in this country, where the temperature is so high, where people are people are creating permission structures for violence. And when I say people, I'm talking political leaders, like political leaders in this country. They're using language and terminology that dehumanizes their opponents. You know, calling people, you know, Nazis and Hitler and fascists and threats to democracy, that dehumanizes your opponents. Because if somebody is actually these things, then, you know, a reasonable person might go, oh, well, we should do something about this, right? And I don't, you know, I'm maybe a little bit cynical here, but I don't actually believe that a lot of the political leaders who are saying these things about their opponents actually believe any of it. I think they recognize this is just an opportunity to keep their base riled up, mm-hmm. and continue to help them try to win elections. And that's a god-awful place to be as a country, and we've got to do better. And it's got to start with some accountability and some self-accountability, and people going, you know what, I have contributed to this problem. I need to dial it back. And quit the finger pointing. And I know that there's, you know, hostile language on both sides of the aisle. I'm not trying to claim that one side has a monopoly on it. But in this day, in this time and moment, it does seem like one side is predominantly using this language that creates this structure for violence. And that's a scary place to be as a conservative in, you know, in politics right now. A lot of the same language that was used about Charlie Kirk to justify and dehumanizing him is language that's been used against me. It's language that's been used against my conservative colleagues on the assembly and just about any Republican elected official in this country. And so it's a scary place to be right now, for sure. And we've got to be able to have these conversations in a way that is respectful and brings the temperature down. And I think that starts with stop using, you know, draconian language. Stop using stark language where it demands violent action.
So I'm just going to jump in there and
I want to say, before you do, this reminds me of the previous interview where you had mentioned feeling threatened as a conservative person, and you pushed back on that.
Yes.
And it was a very interesting bit of back and forth. So
I think that it's perceptional. I think that you can look at policies and practices, and they do certainly meet benchmarks of fascism when you see what terrible things have happened across the country. But to your point about the local government and the feeling of the things that you've heard, I have been in the same email called a Marxist, socialist, communist, fascist and that's not uncommon. This comes a lot in this community, and those people have been arrested at our meetings with weapons and have made me a point of their conversation. And so the left does not own this space. This is a shared space, and it's a space that we definitely can do better at. But I will push back pointedly that there are practices happening in this country right now that should be raising everybody's concern and how our government is implementing its belief in its mandate to police the people, and feels like freedom is being lost. But that's kind of a separate topic, right? Those are the areas we could debate about meaningfully. Sure. But our purpose here was not to kind of raise the flags of federal conversations that could take hours and hours of debate.
Right,
it's really about this local conversation and how we want to model making it better, because in the end, we are problem-solving agents if we take our oaths to heart. We're here to solve the problems, not create the problems.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Your thoughts about how to get to more cohesive work, more collaboration, and respectful debate on issues facing our city and our state with less anger and division. What's needed to bring us more together and be more united rather than fracturing further?
More of this starts here.
Yeah, yeah.
Commitment.
Yeah. Actual, you know, face-to-face
conversations. Yep. Civil commitment, a commitment to doing this the right way. And the right way is the way that hears and then acts, not has an action plan that will only do the action no matter what one hears. You know, I don't know.
You had mentioned that you don't always agree with your own position, mm-hmm. after a good debate. Is that a big piece of what's needed for change? The ability to see things differently without being threatened by that, not feeling angry about changing your mind, having some humility about changing your mind as a strength rather than a feeling of, oh, well, you're giving in, so you're just being crushed by somebody else's ideas.
So I think that we're difficult to talk about that in some ways because we are on the bully pulpit. We have made it through the electoral process. We have faced the public. And in some ways, we are screened to have at least some ability generally. Not everybody who sat on the assembly has had the ability, but most, yes. And so that's a core value for most of us is to actually do the work meaningfully and think and talk and get the work done or do the work in advance so that when you get to the debate table, you actually are prepared to have the debate. Some people haven't quite figured that out because it's a lot of work. And I don't know how that translates into the broader public, that social media sphere.
Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think that we need to be able to acknowledge when our own initial position is wrong and be able to back off that. I think that if we can model that ourselves, then I think that becomes easier to have that conversation with voters and constituents. You know, an example that comes to mind, there's an ordinance coming up that when it was first introduced, I said, absolutely not. Hell no, I'm not voting for that. That's terrible. And then as I got more information, I heard more information. We had work sessions. I had a chance to engage in debate. I was like, oh, this is actually a decent, you know, proposal. And then actually at the end of it, I was like, yeah, I'm going to vote for this now. And the ability to do that, I think, gets drowned out when everybody expects, you know, and everybody expects purity, you know, partisan purity. And I don't think that being able to recognize, hey, my initial take was wrong, is a weakness. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually a strength. And I'll take that if the voters want to quibble with that, they can fire me in 2 years. They're more than welcome to, but I don't think they will. I think the voters will go, hey, that's actually something we appreciate from an elected person. And then hopefully that's something that, you know, people are able to start doing in their own lives and start having those conversations more.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating reality in politics. Like, everybody thinks Congress is terrible, but most people believe their Congress member is doing a great job, which is an interesting kind of parable philosophy to what happens in Anchorage. I want to drill down to the question of kind of how to step back. The conversation that Jared and I had in particular around that text or that social media post, I did unlike the like, and members of a faction started saying, oh, he can't hide it. He liked it. He's just running away from his belief. And I said to Jared, no, this is not why I'm doing this. I'm doing this out of respect for you as a person, because I don't believe it said what you think or for sure what the propaganda said it said. It said what it says. I even ran it through ChatGPT. What does this say? And I handed it back. Like, even the passionless robot says, this is what it means. And it's like, but because I respect you and because you reached out to me with decency, I am going to honor your feelings. Like, that was the move that I made and the why, because I don't want to put him in a position to have to feel bad or whatever feelings come from having to work with somebody who it appears wants to celebrate such things.
We have by email, before we take a quick break, we have an email from Catherine in Fairbanks who says, we're all floating on the same rock through space. So many conflicts over perceived meanings are easily resolved using critical thinking skills and asking questions. Don't assume you understand if you don't. We have more in common than not, and we do ourselves a disservice by reducing the complexity of humans down to left or right, conservative or liberal, or by party affiliations. This is not a single party or political label that encompasses me, or there is not a single party or political label that encompasses me, so I extend that understanding to everyone I meet. It feels so simple, but empathy and a desire to understand is often seen as weakness and trained out of us. If everyone could just watch or rewatch Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the world would be a better place. And on that note, we're going to take a break. We will be back in a minute with more discussion about how to respectfully disagree as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking today about respectful dissent and how we can do a better job of engaging in democracy, debating ideas, talking through and discussing and debating viewpoints without becoming angry or, as we see too often in our country, resulting in violence. In the studio with me is Christopher Constant, who is the Anchorage Assembly Chair, and Jared Gerker, who is Chugiak Eagle River District 2 Assembly Representative. Great topic, and you hit on a very important aspect, that the real or perceived risk of having these conversations. What can be done with the idea of taking a step further and creating safe space within a community or with anyone to have these conversations. Safe conversation on difficult topics is a skill that can be taught and learned. These gentlemen are experienced in civil conversation. How do we work toward that same level of civil conversation among our general communities without underscoring and supporting fear-mongering ideologies?
So what comes to mind immediately is the work of the Alaska Humanities Forum. So long, long time ago, I worked there. We have a member of the assembly who is the chief executive. But in all of those years, they have been a willing convener of difficult dialogues. And so some form of structured disagreement is great as long as it's really meaningfully done and not just with bait meant to make one group of people look somehow bad, right? There's lots of bad faith examples of people trying to convene, but meaningfully convening with open conversation for difficult dialogues, that's what comes to mind. The Humanities Forum has done great work in that space. And we need more, but you know, there's an old adage. There was a book written about 25 years ago, it takes a family. And that turned into a political flag. And then there was a rebuttal to that that was written that said, it takes a village. And I think that both functions make sense. They both have a role. But in my world, when I write this book, it's going to be called It Takes a Table. And it's all about the people you convene around your dinner table, your space where you share a meal and you're willing to have conversations, and not the Thanksgiving table, which with families that gets really awkward sometimes, but meaningfully on a regular basis, who are you inviting in and do you expand that circle so that you can have ongoing conversations with people? Because it's not going to happen top down. It has to happen from the grassroots up. People have to engage. We can promote, we can incentivize, we can help people see the value, but ultimately it has to happen. And I don't know how you break down those rigid divides. And in some ways, it feels like in this moment, there are certain factions on the extremes that are well beyond the ability to converse with each other. And I don't know how you bring them back.
You had said, Chris, in a previous interview, that the public may perceive that there is a lot of division and disagreement within the assembly, but you said 90% of the time that's not true.
Or more.
So how do you handle the 10%, both of you, in a respectful way? Because clearly there's going to be some times when it's not an agreement.
So there's like thousands of years of parliamentary procedure that have been established and honed into this process that we use. And the process that we use is improved annually. Every time we see a problem, we fix the problem. We use Robert's Rules of Order. The legislature uses Mason's. It's a little bit different. The core value in Robert's Rules is that the majority rules, period. There are rare occasions when a supermajority is required, and that's in the time when you would be taking away someone's rights. That's like a motion to end debate or, stop people from being able to further discuss a matter because we're done. We all know where we are. It takes 8 votes instead of 7. And so there's a functional process. Also, when things get heated, you hew more to the rules than you would otherwise. Mm. Procedures are there for you when things get hot. So when there is that tension, you work to ensure that everybody is getting in the line, speaking in their turn, and that the rules are followed very closely. We have customs, we have rules, we have the code. That's kind of how we engender it all. And then the body, when it gets really intense, speaks to the chair and the chair alone, so that it's not speaking to the motive of the other person mm-hmm. and why they're doing whatever they're doing or what they said, how much it hurts because they came across too personal. You say, please talk to the chair, right? Mr. Chair, here's the problem. The idea is bad. You don't speak about the person being bad. You speak about the idea, and here's why the idea is bad. But that takes practice, and that's really kind of where we have our community councils set up, which are not great at this. They have their moments, but that's I call it the womb of democracy. That's the place where the baby is formed and starts to grow into the community and be part of the process. So they make way more mistakes and they're way less formal and it gets really hot because it's as close to the grassroots as you get. And so we help them to be stronger at doing the process and learning how things work and engaging civilly in those spaces. So as it rolls up to us and into the space we're in, we do our best. So I think it's this hewing to the rules is what makes it work for us, but that doesn't get into the softer social side of all of these conversations.
And do you talk about to folks with the community councils or when new people are starting on the assembly about sort of those rules of engagement? Are there some clearly defined, we're going to agree to these standards and how we debate things? Do you have?
So our code has model bylaws for community councils. Their bylaws have to comply, which means who can attend, who's a member, who can vote, right? Those kind of things are worked out, how debate's supposed to happen, when you notice meetings, so they're publicly noticed. But for us, we do have my favorite committee. It's the only one I chair as the chair. It's the Rules Committee, and we talk about these things regularly, like once a month. Over the last month, it was clear that we aren't doing this very well. We need to do better. Here's ways to look at this problem that can help you be successful, right? So we do, and that was started by, at the time, L.V. Gray Jackson and Dick Traney, who realized that the assembly needed a space that we could convene and improve itself regularly. And so that's how we do it structured, but independently, I don't know, as members, it's different.
I guess what I'm hearing is we need to do massive Robert Rules training for everybody. So at the Thanksgiving table, it's Robert's Rules of Order procedures. At the table. That's right. It's like, we have procedures, Grandma. Look, I think that we have to, at the local level, on the assembly, you're right. We agree on, I mean, the majority of the stuff that happens is unanimous vote. It's just the nuts and bolts of good local government. And I do agree that process protects. That's a big thing I've believed in throughout my entire career, is that if we have established rules of engagement, we're going to be able to adhere to that better. And it's not going to get personal, because, you know, we've agreed we're not going to be personal. I think that's one of the most important things about how we engage. And if we do get personal, we get called out. Hey, mm-hmm. That's, you've broken the rules. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, my bad. And now I got a chance to correct. Or if I don't, then there's the potential for the body to say, okay, well, we're tired of you talking now. You're done, right? Mm-hmm. And they can vote on that. So I think that accountability is really important. I think that's what keeps it on the rails. And yeah, absent, you know, doing massive Robert's Rules training for everybody else, I think that the message you can take from that for everybody else is, have agreed upon rules of engagement, and not necessarily, it doesn't have to be formalized or structured or anything like that. Just be like, hey, at the end of the day, you're my friend, you're my coworker, you're my family member, whatever it might be, and I love you, and this is, you as a person are more important to me than anything with your politics. And if we can get to that kind of a place, I think we're going to be in a much better spot as a country, for sure.
And just some very simple rules, such as no name calling, no shouting someone down, listening to really take in and absorb the information, instead of, as you had mentioned, just waiting to be able to respond and without really thinking through what that response could be. So
world, where it really comes down to most, the disagreement in that space, hey, point of order, something's not right. It's when a member believes you are mischaracterizing their intention, right? And so, and that's easy to do, and it's a real practice not to do. And the goal is to not speak to their intention. You don't know why somebody is doing something. You can't speak to the package of values and experiences that Jared has that convinces him that deciding yes or no is the right thing, but instead you speak to the no or yes, the problem you're trying to solve, the value set within the question you're trying to fix, and not why this person is doing this thing. You know, that's the hardest part in our process for members to really get in a practice of, and it's easy to step over the line, and most members catch themselves and bring it back because we reinforce this. But I think this gets to a bigger issue, and the bigger issue, this is the national question, and it's the state question, it's at the local government question, but it's really in the community. And that is, we have operated under a social contract for a long time, that we have political processes, and sometimes you win and sometimes you lose, and we work through these things. And that social contract appears to be fraying. And the question at the broader kind of the meta level is like, how do we rebuild the social contract? And I think that our effort here is one layer of that, that we're here to say, we are doing this. We disagree on a lot of things. We both like Lord of the Rings, though.
That is true. Big Lord of the Rings fans, actually.
And he isn't on the side of the Red Dark Tower, no. Like, we're both, you know, philosophically how we see ourselves when you
finding
come to the question of intent.
Points of agreement and shared humanity. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Texas Dave is in Palmer. Hello.
Oh, good morning. How are y'all?
Good.
I want to thank the two council members this morning. Because I can agree with both of the council members and with your statements.
We're breaking up a little, Dave.
Excuse me.
Go ahead. You're breaking up a little bit.
Hear me now?
Somewhat. Go ahead.
Yeah, y'all have a bad tone system this morning.
Something. I'm sorry that we're having trouble with this connection, because I certainly would love to hear what you have to say. Do you want to try again, and we'll see if we can still hear you? Yeah, something. I don't know what's happening. I'm so sorry.
Maybe you can call back in and try one more time on the line.
Try a different line, perhaps. We do have an email from Stu in Eagle River. He says he wants to point out that a lot of politicians have learned that making their base angry is a good way to motivate them to get to the ballot box. He called it enragement engagement. He noted it's easier to vilify people than it is to have a robust political platform. And I, you know, one thing, I mentioned this in the open, the fact that online platforms don't have this liability concern. The 1996 Communications Decency Act has Section 230, Section 230C specifies that service providers and users may not be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. In other words, newspapers, broadcasters can be sued if they publish or air something that is untrue or libelous, but those rules do not apply to online platform service providers, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok. Social media posters can lie as much as they want and even make money from those lies with no legal responsibility to the truth. And the owners of the platforms they spread disinformation on are not held liable. Do you think this needs to change?
I think it gets to a really dangerous place when we're talking about being the arbiters of truth. Because what is truth, right? And so no, I it's not ideal. I definitely, you know, it's not great that people go out there and just say whatever they want to say and you know, spread whatever they want to spread. But at the same time, I do think that is their right to do that. I think it gets us to a pretty scary place when the government or, you know, whoever might be stepping in and saying, you know what, no, that's I don't want you saying that. We've deemed that to be untrue. And, you know, not to bring national politics into it, but look at kind of what the conversation around COVID, you know, and then all the vaccines and everything that came after that. There were people raising questions and concerns about the origins of COVID, about the efficacy of the vaccines, and their voices were silenced, right? We know this for a fact that the government reached out to social media companies and said, hey, we don't want these specific posts, you know, being able to get out there and people being able to see, we want you to silence them. That's a very bad place for us to be as a society. So democracy is a dangerous thing, right? It's one of those things that we have to, you know, engage in it responsibly. But it gets us, it's such a worse place to be where the government's going to step in and be the arbiters of truth.
I want to add briefly to that.
We need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll rejoin
that. A contemporary example.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Talk of Alaska will be back in just a moment. All right, welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We were talking about, should there be limits on what's allowed online? And Jared, you were pushing back on that idea, saying, do we want the government telling us what to think or say? And Chris, you wanted to give an example.
Right. So just the Charlie Kirk story, as we watched it unfold, and there was a massive backlash where people, in my opinion, didn't say anything radical or unsavory even. Jimmy Kimmel is the story, where he was, through presidential fiat and force, it appears, forced off the air through threats by the FCC and the Federal Communications Commission. And what was interesting about that in the end, though, was broadcasters of all stripes of all stripes stood up and said, no, this is not the American way. This is not freedom of speech. And we cannot be using the government to extort speakers to have the government's position, because that is not an acceptable, free, open exchange of ideas.
But where should the lines be? Just as free speech doesn't mean you can knowingly put people at risk, yelling fire in a crowded theater when there is no fire. You can't do that. Should there be any other restrictions on speech? And if so, who decides and how?
So I think that we aren't going to solve the national conundrum. And I think we all recognize the weaknesses of the systems that exist. And we have to be working in our own lives to make that better. But my tactic has been to tune out most of those social media platforms. Don't go there, because it feels like it is actually engineered to raise this heat.
Well, in some ways, it certainly is. The algorithms, we know, if you're outraged by something, it'll dish you up some more. Here's some more outrage.
And so I've had to make a personal decision to avoid engaging in those wars, because they do not, it's kind of like the rotary values, is it good, is it kind, does it help? You know, mostly the answer is no, so I don't have time for that right now.
Well, and Jared, you had mentioned that too. Algorithms reward outrage, nice posts might get buried. You had a cashier at a local store, you were relaying this story in an earlier discussion, tell you about an issue some Anchorage people were upset about, and it meant they were roasting you on Reddit. You said you didn't care because it's not a real place. Is it that easy, really, to shrug it off for you? Did you, or were you tempted to look at what was being said, or did you just ignore it?
You know, I want to get to that. I do want to circle back real quick to something about Jimmy Kimmel. If there was pressure put on by the government to have Jimmy Kimmel removed from the air, then yes, I would say that would be a violation of free speech. But people who were commenting and posting things about, you know, celebrating Charlie Kirk's deaths, and their employers decided to let them go, I think that is a different thing. I don't think that's a free speech violation
necessarily.
Except
for the vice president did say, if you're unhappy about what somebody posted, call their employer.
So I agree with you, Jared. I agree with you. The free speech does not force your employer or those who you are engaged with in the world to have to deal with you. You are not free from consequences.
Correct.
Period. That is a firm line.
But
for
you
me.
Are free from the government stepping in and saying there will be consequences for you doing
right.
this.
You if you
be.
Don't yes. act, then this is going to happen.
Right.
Or the kind of mafia style.
Right. And so if you've got an employee, you know, posting just horrific things, then as an employer, you have every right to fire that person. That's not a violation of free speech.
So now I have to speak to that briefly, because I work at a company in my private life that I won't mention in detail, but there was a kind of an employee at the lowest level of the organization. I'm the executive. And this person had all kinds of things to say. And we are a company that believes in second chances. It provides drug and alcohol treatment services and have helped people get on their feet for having done horrible things in the community. And so we are not the kind of organization that would fire somebody, but we showed them our policy. We counseled them and made it so that it was they understood, and we talked to the people who we feel like needed to hear from us, and that storm went away because it was addressed in a meaningful way. And I think that that is a kind of the social part of this is where the work has to happen. But I fully agree that we cannot be telling employers, if you don't like what they said, then you can't let them go.
Well, Jared, you had discussed earlier the damaging labels that people use online to try to goad someone into an argument or give them an offensive label that others will then pile on more angst. Years before the internet, I heard an organizer who was working with people countering protests at boat landings after off-reservation tribal spearfishing rights were restored to Midwestern tribes. One of the people at the gathering said, "So, what are your ideas for how we counter these rednecks?" And the organizer's answer was, start by not calling them rednecks. How much of the deep divisions we see today do you think spring from just that, dehumanizing the other side, trying to pigeonhole someone's entire life and their beliefs into a single damaging word or phrase? You're a fascist, or you're an enemy of the state. Is that where a lot of this just comes down to, is just that flame throwing and name calling?
Yeah, I think that is a huge part of the problem. If somebody's able to say, you know, I think you're a Nazi because you believe X, Y, and Z. If that's what you believe, then why should you engage with me in any meaningful way on anything else, right? Why does it matter? Why would you? If I was a Nazi, why would you work with me, right? Like there's absolutely no reason that you would. And I think that, you know, I'd mentioned it a little bit earlier, but I think that nationally, I think there's a lot of political leaders who weaponize these terms because they know that it's going to keep their base riled up and engaged. And I think that as civic leaders, especially here at the local level, we have a responsibility to, you know, to model a different way and not use that language and disagree and grapple with the substance and the ideas of the person, not with the actual person. And that does require, you know, personal accountability and being like, no, I am going to not engage in this way. I am not going to sit here and, you know, call Chris horrible names, and Chris isn't going to call me horrible names. Probably, hopefully not.
I don't.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
I get chastised for it.
But yeah, no. And so we've got to stop using that language. And as civic leaders, we have a responsibility to model that way and then call out others who are also civic leaders who are not engaging in that.
I would offer, though, that there's a difference between our muni business and our national business, and you and I and everyone else has a right to speak as we feel on the issues that aren't necessarily at the municipal table. And you, like, those employer conversations have to deal with the realities or the potential splashback of your constituencies and others feeling like you don't represent and maybe deciding you don't represent and giving you walking papers. And so I agree there is some care, and I am more careful than I would otherwise be, but I will be out there on Saturday with some sign. I don't know what it's going to say at that No Kings rally because I believe we're in a dangerous time. And so I
wanted to, we only have a couple minutes left here, and I wanted to get back to a little bit of communication in a broader sense. Chris, you got rid of X, formerly Twitter. You ramped down your social media use. Do you think there is a way to get to a better way to engage so that you can help share important information in that mass communication way? So it can be effective to reach a lot of people quickly.
I rely on our team at the assembly to do some of that broader communication. I got to the point in the pandemic, it was really dark, and there were so many horrible things being said that I had to set up human filters and, okay, you just tell me if this one feels like an actionable threat to my or my family's safety, then share it with me. Please stop sharing otherwise, because it's a threat to my mental state to have to see this perpetual barrage of hatred coming at me in very personal ways. And so that screened it down to maybe 1% of the communications coming my way that threatened guns, threatened my house, threatened my friends, threatened my employer, that were real, tangible, that had to be shared with law enforcement because I felt like I needed to do something active, you know. And so for me, I just got to the point where I was literally setting up physical filters. Might as well just filter it all together.
And Jared, you have a different idea about this. Talk about what you try to do online.
Yeah, you know, I think that if we cede the space completely to the trolls, then it becomes a troll's lair. And so we can't do that. And so I understand, I appreciate what Chris is saying, but I think that it's important that we stay in that space, we stay engaged, we continue to communicate in a way that's you know, appropriate and modeling a better way. I do use social media actively for my government account to highlight, you know, what am I doing on the assembly, ways for people to engage with me and talk with me. Is it always nice? Do people are always nice to me? No, actually, they're usually not. And that's okay. Because I'm not going to let that space get overrun. I'm going to, you know, stake out my territory. Hey, this is going to be a place where we can have conversation, where I'm going to present information. And if you want to, you know, if you want to act a fool, that's your prerogative, I guess. But I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to model that. And we're gonna let this be a place where people can come have a conversation.
So tricky though, because there are open records laws there that you don't control on your public social media who can say what or when.
Do you have like one or two takeaways that you want people to think about how to disagree in a better way?
Yeah. First things, stop using dehumanizing language. Stop calling your opponents names that could lead to violence. Right. That's the first thing. The second thing, agree to rules of engagement beforehand. It doesn't have to be formalized Robert's Rules of Order, but it does need to be something that you are my brother, you are my sister, my friend. We will not disagree in a way that's hurtful to each other.
And I agree with that. It is all at the human layer. The algorithm doesn't love you. It's only made for one reason, but connect with your neighbors. Your neighbors are what's important in this big grand experiment called local government, called your state, called where you live right now. And so lean into your neighbors. It takes a table.
It does. And face-to-face discussions rather than that online kind of false sense of a world that exists there that's really not real. Thank you so much to our guests today, Christopher Constant, the Anchorage Assembly Chair, and Jared Gerker, who is the Chugiak Eagle River District 2 Assembly Representative. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, our editor is Annie Feit, and on the phones, Ava White helped us out today, even though we had phone issues. Sorry about that, folks who tried to call in. We'll be back next week, and we will be talking about the recovery efforts after the terrible storm. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.